coat hanging on its hook along with her own. Reflectively, she pulled out her phone to check for messages. Nothing. A voice echoed again in her memory.
That which your brother believes is hidden in D.C.,
it can be found. Sometimes a legend that endures for centuries endures for a reason.
No, Catherine said aloud. It can't possibly be real.
Sometimes a legend was just that. A legend. Chapter 16. Security Chief Trent Anderson stormed back toward the Capitol Rotunda, fuming at the failure of his security team. One of his men had just found a sling and an army surplus jacket in an alcove near the east portico.
The goddamn guy walked right out of here.
Anderson had already assigned teams to start scanning exterior video, but by the time they found anything, this guy would be long gone. Now, as Anderson entered the rotunda to survey the damage, he saw that the situation had been contained as well as could be expected. All four entrances to the rotunda were closed with as inconspicuous a method of crowd control as security had at its disposal. A velvet swag, an apologetic guard, and a sign that read, "This room temporarily closed for cleaning." The dozen or so witnesses were all being herded into a group on the eastern perimeter of the room, where the guards were collecting cell phones and cameras.
The last thing Anderson needed was for one of these people to send a cell phone snapshot to CNN.
One of the detained witnesses, a tall, dark-haired man in a tweed sport coat, was trying to break away from the group to speak to the chief. The man was currently in a heated discussion with the guards.
"I'll speak to him in a moment," Anderson called over to the guards. "For now, please hold everyone in the main lobby until we sort this out."
Anderson turned his eyes now to the hand, which stood at attention in the middle of the room.
"For the love of God."
In 15 years on security detail for the Capitol building, he had seen some strange things, but nothing like this.
"Forensics had better get here fast and get this thing out of my building."
Anderson moved closer, seeing that the bloody wrist had been skewered on a spiked wooden base to make the hand stand up. Wood and flesh, he thought, invisible to metal detectors.
The only metal was a large gold ring, which Anderson assumed had either been wanded or casually pulled off the dead finger by the suspect, as if it were his own.
Anderson crouched down to examine the hand. It looked as if it had belonged to a man of about 60. The ring bore some kind of ornate seal with a two-headed bird and the number 33. Anderson didn't recognize it. What really caught his eye were the tiny tattoos on the tips of the thumb and index finger.
A goddamn freak show.
"Chief?" One of the guards hurried over, holding out a phone. "Personal call for you. Security switchboard just patched it through." Anderson looked at him like he was insane.
"I'm in the middle of something here," he growled.
The guard's face was pale. He covered the mouthpiece and whispered,
"It's CIA.
Anderson did a double take.
"CIA heard about this already? It's their office of security."
Anderson stiffened.
"Holy shit."
He glanced uneasily at the phone in the guard's hand. In Washington's vast ocean of intelligence agencies, the CIA's office of security was something of a Bermuda Triangle, a mysterious and treacherous region from which all who knew of it steered clear whenever possible. With a seemingly self-destructive mandate, the OS had been created by the CIA for one strange purpose: to spy on the CIA itself. Like a powerful internal affairs office, the OS monitored all CIA employees for illicit behavior, misappropriation of funds, selling of secrets, stealing classified technologies, and use of illegal torture tactics, to name a few.
They spy on America's spies.
With investigative carte blanche in all matters of national security, the OS had a long and potent reach. Anderson could not fathom why they would be interested in this incident at the Capitol, or how they had found out so fast. Then again, the OS was rumored to have eyes everywhere. For all Anderson knew, they had a direct feed of U.S. Capitol security cameras. This incident did not match OS directives in any way, although the timing of the call seemed too coincidental to Anderson to be about anything other than this severed hand.
"Chief?"
The guard was holding the phone out to him like a hot potato.
"You need to take this call right now. It's..."
He paused and silently mouthed two syllables. "Sa-to." Anderson squinted hard at the man.
"You got to be kidding."
He felt his palms begin to sweat. Sato is handling this personally?
The overlord of the Office of Security, Director Inoue Sato, was a legend in the intelligence community. Born inside the fences of a Japanese internment camp in Manzanar, California, in the aftermath of Pearl Harbor, Sato was a toughened survivor who had never forgotten the horrors of war or the perils of insufficient military intelligence. Now, having risen to one of the most secretive and potent posts in U.S. intelligence work, Sato had proven an uncompromising patriot as well as a terrifying enemy to any who stood in opposition. Seldom seen, but universally feared, the OS director cruised the deep waters of the CIA like a leviathan who surfaced only to devour its prey. Anderson had met Sato face to face only once, and the memory of looking into those cold black eyes was enough to make him count his blessings that he would be having this conversation by telephone. Anderson took the phone and brought it to his lips.
"Director Sato," he said in as friendly a voice as possible. "This is Chief Anderson. How may I—" "There is a man in your building to whom I need to speak immediately."
The OS director's voice was unmistakable, like gravel grating on a chalkboard. Throat cancer surgery had left Sato with a profoundly unnerving intonation and a repulsive neck scar to match.
"I want you to find him for me immediately."
"That's all? You want me to page someone?" Anderson felt suddenly hopeful that maybe the timing of this call was pure coincidence.
"Who are you looking for?"
"His name is Robert Langdon. I believe he is inside your building right now."
Langdon? The name sounded vaguely familiar, but Anderson couldn't quite place it. He was now wondering if Sato knew about the hand.
"I'm in the rotunda at the moment," Anderson said, "but we've got some tourists here. Hold on."
He lowered his phone and called out to the group.
"Folks, is there anyone here by the name of Langdon?"
After a short silence, a deep voice replied from the crowd of tourists.
"Yes, I'm Robert Langdon."
Sato knows all. Anderson craned his neck, trying to see who had spoken up. The same man who had been trying to get to him earlier stepped away from the others. He looked distraught, but familiar somehow. Anderson raised the phone to his lips.
"Yes, Mr. Langdon is here."
"Put him on,"
Sato said, coarsely. Anderson exhaled. "Better him than me."
"Hold on."
He waved Langdon over. As Langdon approached, Anderson suddenly realized why the name sounded familiar.
"I just read an article about this guy. What the hell is he doing here?"
Despite Langdon's 6-foot frame and athletic build, Anderson saw none of the cold, hardened edge he expected from a man famous for surviving an explosion at the Vatican and a manhunt in Paris.
"This guy eluded the French police? In loafers?"
He looked more like someone Anderson would expect to find hearthside in some Ivy League library, reading Dostoevsky.
"Mr. Langdon,"
Anderson said, walking halfway to meet him.
"I'm Chief Anderson. I handle security here. You have a phone call."
"For me?" Langdon's blue eyes looked anxious and uncertain. Anderson held out the phone.
"It's the CIA's Office of Security."
"I've never heard of it." Anderson smiled ominously.
"Well, sir, it's heard of you."
Langdon put the phone to his ear.
"Yes?"
"Robert Langdon?"
Director Sato's harsh voice blared in the tiny speaker, loud enough that Anderson could hear.
"Yes,"
Langdon replied. Anderson stepped closer to hear what Sato was saying.
"This is Director Inoue Sato, Mr. Langdon. I'm handling a crisis at the moment, and I believe you have information that can help me."
Langdon looked hopeful. "Is this about Peter Solomon? Do you know where he is?" Peter Solomon? Anderson felt entirely out of the loop.
"Professor,"
Sato replied,
"I am asking the questions at the moment."
"Peter Solomon is in very serious trouble," Langdon exclaimed. "Some madman just—"
"Excuse me,"
Sato said, cutting him off. Anderson cringed. Bad move. Interrupting a top CIA official's line of questioning was a mistake only a civilian would make. I thought Langdon was supposed to be smart.
"Listen carefully,"
Sato said.
"As we speak, this nation is facing a crisis. I have been advised that you have information that can help me avert it. Now I'm going to ask you again. What information do you possess?"
Langdon looked lost. "Director, I have no idea what you're talking about. All I'm concerned with is finding Peter and—"
"No idea?"
Sato challenged. Anderson saw Langdon bristle. The professor now took a more aggressive tone.
"No, sir, no damned idea at all."
Anderson winced.
Wrong, wrong, wrong.
Robert Langdon had just made a very costly mistake in dealing with Director Sato. Incredibly, Anderson now realized it was too late. To his astonishment, Director Sato had just appeared on the far side of the rotunda and was approaching fast behind Langdon.
Sato is in the building?
Anderson held his breath and braced for impact.
Langdon has no idea.
The director's dark form drew closer, phone held to ear, black eyes locked like two lasers on Langdon's back. Langdon clutched the police chief's phone and felt a rising frustration as the OS director pressed him.
I'm sorry, sir, Langdon said tersely, but I can't read your mind. What do you want from me? What do I want from you?
The OS director's grating voice crackled through Langdon's phone, scraping and hollow, like that of a dying man with strep throat. As the man spoke, Langdon felt a tap on his shoulder. He turned, and his eyes were drawn down, directly into the face of a tiny Japanese woman. She had a fierce expression, a mottled complexion, thinning hair, tobacco-stained teeth, and an unsettling white scar that sliced horizontally across her neck. The woman's gnarled hand held a cell phone to her ear, and when her lips moved, Langdon heard the familiar raspy voice through his cell phone.
What do I want from you, Professor?
She calmly closed her phone and glared at him.
For starters, you can stop calling me sir.
Langdon stared, mortified.
Ma'am, I apologize. Our connection was poor and—
Our connection was fine, Professor,
she said,
and I have an extremely low tolerance for bullshit.
Chapter 17. Director Inoue Sato was a fearsome specimen, a bristly tempest of a woman who stood a mere 4 feet 10 inches. She was bone thin, with jagged features, and a dermatological condition known as vitiligo, which gave her complexion the mottled look of coarse granite blotched with lichen. Her rumpled blue pantsuit hung on her emaciated frame like a loose sack, the open-necked blouse doing nothing to hide the scar across her neck. It had been noted by her co-workers that Sato's only acquiescence to physical vanity appeared to be that of plucking her substantial mustache. For over a decade, Inoue Sato had overseen the CIA's Office of Security. She possessed an off-the-chart IQ and chillingly accurate instincts, a combination which girded her with a self-confidence that made her terrifying to anyone who could not perform the impossible. Not even a terminal diagnosis of aggressive throat cancer had knocked her from her perch. The battle had cost her 1 month of work, half her voice box, and a third of her body weight, but she returned to the office as if nothing had happened. Inoue Sato appeared to be indestructible. Robert Langdon suspected he was probably not the first to mistake Sato for a man on the phone, but the director was still glaring at him with simmering black eyes.
Again, my apologies, ma'am, Langdon said. I'm still trying to get my bearings here. The person who claims to have Peter Solomon tricked me into coming to D.C. this evening.
He pulled the fax from his jacket. This is what he sent me earlier. I wrote down the tail number of the plane he sent, so maybe if you call the FAA and track the—
Sato's tiny hand shot out and snatched the sheet of paper. She stuck it in her pocket without even opening it.
Professor, I am running this investigation, and until you start telling me what I want to know, I suggest you not speak unless spoken to.
Sato now spun to the police chief.
Chief Anderson,
she said, stepping entirely too close and staring up at him through tiny black eyes.
Would you care to tell me what the hell is going on here? The guard at the east gate told me you found a human hand on the floor. Is that true?
Anderson stepped to the side and revealed the object in the center of the floor.
Yes, ma'am. Only a few minutes ago.
She glanced at the hand as if it were nothing more than a misplaced piece of clothing.
And yet, you didn't mention it to me when I called.
I thought you knew.
Do not lie to me.
Anderson wilted under her gaze, but his voice remained confident.
Ma'am, this situation is under control.
I really doubt that,
Sato said with equal confidence.
A forensics team is on the way. Whoever did this may have left fingerprints.
Sato looked skeptical.
I think someone clever enough to walk through your security checkpoint with a human hand is probably clever enough not to leave fingerprints.
That may be true, but I have a responsibility to investigate.
Actually, I'm relieving you of your responsibility as of this moment. I am taking over.
Anderson stiffened. This is not exactly OS domain, is it?
Absolutely. This is an issue of national security.
Peter's hand?
Langdon wondered, watching their exchange in a daze.
National security? Langdon was sensing that his own urgent goal of finding Peter was not Sato's. The OS director seemed to be on another page entirely. Anderson looked puzzled as well.
National security? With all due respect, ma'am.
The last I checked, she interrupted, I outrank you. I suggest you do exactly as I say, and that you do it without question.
Anderson nodded and swallowed hard.
But shouldn't we at least print the fingers to confirm the hand belongs to Peter Solomon?
I'll confirm it, Langdon said, feeling a sickening certainty. I recognize his ring and his hand. He paused. The tattoos are new, though. Someone did that to him recently.
I'm sorry.
Sato looked unnerved for the first time since arriving.
The hand is tattooed?
Langdon nodded. The thumb has a crown, and the index finger a star. Sato pulled out a pair of glasses and walked toward the hand, circling like a shark. Also, Langdon said, although you can't see the other three fingers, I'm certain they will have tattoos on the fingertips as well. Sato looked intrigued by the comment and motioned to Anderson.
Chief, can you look at the other fingertips for us, please?
Anderson crouched down beside the hand, being careful not to touch it. He put his cheek near the floor and looked up under the clenched fingertips.
He's right, ma'am. All of the fingertips have tattoos. Although I can't quite see what the other...
A sun, a lantern, and a key, Langdon said flatly. Sato turned fully to Langdon now, her small eyes appraising him.
And how exactly would you know that?
Langdon stared back. The image of a human hand, marked in this way on the fingertips, is a very old icon. It's known as the Hand of the Mysteries. Anderson stood up abruptly.
This thing has a name?
Langdon nodded. It's one of the most secretive icons of the ancient world. Sato cocked her head.
And might I ask what the hell it's doing in the middle of the U.S. Capitol?
Langdon wished he would wake up from this nightmare. Traditionally, ma'am, it was used as an invitation.
An invitation to what?
She demanded. Langdon looked down at the symbols on his friend's severed hand. For centuries, the Hand of the Mysteries served as a mystical summons. Basically, it's an invitation to receive secret knowledge, protected wisdom known only to an elite few. Sato folded her thin arms and stared up at him with jet-black eyes.
Well, Professor, for someone who claims to have no clue why he's here, you're doing quite well so far.
Chapter 18 Catherine Solomon donned her white lab coat and began her usual arrival routine, her rounds, as her brother called them. Like a nervous parent checking on a sleeping baby, Catherine poked her head into the mechanical room. The hydrogen fuel cell was running smoothly, its backup tanks all safely nestled in their racks. Catherine continued down the hall to the data storage room. As always, the two redundant holographic backup units hummed safely within their temperature-controlled vault.
All of my research, she thought,
gazing in through the 3-inch-thick shatterproof glass. Holographic data storage devices, unlike their refrigerator-size ancestors, looked more like sleek stereo components, each perched atop a columnar pedestal. Both of her lab's holographic drives were synchronized and identical, serving as redundant backups to safeguard identical copies of her work. Most backup protocols advocated a secondary backup system off-site, in case of earthquake, fire, or theft, but Catherine and her brother agreed that secrecy was paramount. Once this data left the building to an off-site server, they could no longer be certain it would stay private. Content that everything was running smoothly here, she headed back down the hallway. As she rounded the corner, however, she spotted something unexpected across the lab. What in the world? A muted glow was glinting off all the equipment. She hurried in to have a look, surprised to see light emanating from behind the plexiglass wall of the control room.
He's here.
Catherine flew across the lab, arriving at the control room door and heaving it open.
Peter?
She said, running in. The plump woman seated at the control room's terminal jumped up.
Oh my God, Catherine, you scared me.
Trish Dunn, the only other person on Earth allowed back here, was Catherine's Metasystems assistant and seldom worked weekends. The 26-year-old redhead was a genius data modeler and had signed a non-disclosure document worthy of the KGB. Tonight she was apparently analyzing data on the control room's plasma wall, a huge flat-screen display that looked like something out of NASA Mission Control.
Sorry, Trish said. I didn't know you were here yet. I was trying to finish up before you and your brother arrived. Have you spoken to him? He's late and he's not answering his phone.
Trish shook her head.
I bet he's still trying to figure out how to use that new iPhone you gave him.
Catherine appreciated Trish's good humor, and Trish's presence here had just given her an idea.
Actually, I'm glad you're in tonight. You might be able to help me with something, if you don't mind. Whatever it is, I'm sure it beats football.
Catherine took a deep breath, calming her mind.
I'm not sure how to explain this, but earlier today I heard an unusual story.
Trish Dunn didn't know what story Catherine Solomon had heard, but clearly it had her on edge. Her boss's usually calm gray eyes looked anxious, and she had tucked her hair behind her ears 3 times since entering the room, a nervous tell, as Trish called it. Brilliant scientist, lousy poker player.
To me, Catherine said, this story sounds like fiction, an old legend, and yet...
She paused, tucking a wisp of hair behind her ears once again.
And yet?
Catherine sighed.
And yet I was told today by a trusted source that the legend is true.
Okay. Where is she going with this?
I'm going to talk to my brother about it, but it occurs to me that maybe you can help me shed some light on it before I do. I'd love to know if this legend has ever been corroborated anywhere else in history.
In all of history? Catherine nodded.
Anywhere in the world, in any language, at any point in history.
Strange request, Trish thought, but certainly feasible. 10 years ago, the task would have been impossible. Today, however, with the Internet, the World Wide Web, and the ongoing digitization of the great libraries and museums in the world, Catherine's goal could be achieved by using a relatively simple search engine equipped with an army of translation modules and some well-chosen keywords.
No problem, Trish said.
Many of the lab's research books contained passages in ancient languages, and so Trish was often asked to write specialized optical character recognition translation modules to generate English text from obscure languages. She had to be the only metasystems specialist on Earth who had built OCR translation modules in Old Frisian, Mek, and Akkadian. The modules would help, but the trick to building an effective search spider was all in choosing the right keywords. Unique, but not overly restrictive. Catherine looked to be a step ahead of Trish, and was already jotting down possible keywords on a slip of paper. Catherine had written down several when she paused, thought a moment, and then wrote several more.
Okay,
she finally said, handing Trish the slip of paper. Trish perused the list of search strings and her eyes grew wide.
What kind of crazy legend is Catherine investigating? You want me to search for all of these key phrases?
One of the words Trish didn't even recognize.
Is that even English? Do you really think we'll find all of these in one place, verbatim? I'd like to try.
Trish would have said impossible, but the I word was banned here. Catherine considered it a dangerous mindset in a field that often transformed preconceived falsehoods into confirmed truths. Trish Dunn seriously doubted this key phrase search would fall into that category.
How long for results?
Catherine asked.
A few minutes to write the spider and launch it. After that, maybe 15 for the spider to exhaust itself.
So fast? Catherine looked encouraged. Trish nodded. Traditional search engines often required a full day to crawl across the entire online universe, find new documents, digest their content, and add it to their searchable database. But this was not the kind of search spider Trish would write.
I'll write a program called a delegator, Trish explained. It's not entirely kosher, but it's fast. Essentially, it's a program that orders other people's search engines to do our work. Most databases have a search function built in. Libraries, museums, universities, governments. So I write a spider that finds their search engines, inputs your keywords, and asks them to search. This way we harness the power of thousands of engines working in unison.
Catherine looked impressed.
Parallel processing.
A kind of metasystem.
I'll call you if I get anything. I appreciate it, Trish.
Catherine patted her on the back and headed for the door.
I'll be in the library.
Trish settled in to write the program. Coding a search spider was a menial task far below her skill level, but Trish Dunn didn't care. She would do anything for Catherine Solomon. Sometimes Trish still couldn't believe the good fortune that had brought her here.
You've come a long way, baby.
Just over a year ago, Trish had quit her job as a metasystems analyst in one of the high-tech industry's many cubicle farms. In her off hours, she did some freelance programming and started an industry blog, Future Applications in Computational Metasystem Analysis, although she doubted anyone read it. Then one evening her phone rang.
Tristan, a woman's voice asked politely.
Yes, who's calling, please?
My name is Catherine Solomon.
Trish almost fainted on the spot.
Catherine Solomon?
I just read your book, Noetic Science, Modern Gateway to Ancient Wisdom, and I wrote about it on my blog.
Yes, I know, the woman replied graciously. That's why I'm calling.
Of course it is, Trish realized, feeling dumb. Even brilliant scientists Google themselves.
Your blog intrigues me, Catherine told her. I wasn't aware Metasystems modeling had come so far.
Yes, ma'am,
Trish managed, starstruck.
Data models are an exploding technology with far-reaching applications.
For several minutes, the two women chatted about Trish's work in Metasystems, discussing her experience analyzing, modeling, and predicting the flow of massive data fields.
Obviously, your book is way over my head, Trish said, but I understood enough to see an intersection with my Metasystems work. Your blog said you believe Metasystems modeling can transform the study of noetics.
Absolutely. I believe Metasystems could turn noetics into real science.
Real science?
Catherine's tone hardened slightly.
As opposed to...
Oh, shit, that came out wrong.
What I meant is that noetics is more esoteric.
Catherine laughed.
Relax, I'm kidding. I get that all the time.
I'm not surprised, Trish thought. Even the Institute of Noetic Sciences in California described the field in arcane and abstruse language, defining it as the study of mankind's direct and immediate access to knowledge beyond what is available to our normal senses and the power of reason. The word noetic, Trish had learned, derived from the ancient Greek nous, translating roughly to inner knowledge or intuitive consciousness.
I'm interested in your Metasystems work, Catherine said, and how it might relate to a project I'm working on. Any chance you'd be willing to meet? I'd love to pick your brain.
Catherine Solomon wants to pick my brain? It felt like Maria Sharapova had called for tennis tips. The next day, a white Volvo pulled into Trish's driveway, and an attractive, willowy woman in blue jeans got out. Trish immediately felt 2 feet tall.
Great, she groaned. Smart, rich, and thin. And I'm supposed to believe God is good?
But Catherine's unassuming air set Trish instantly at ease. The two of them settled in on Trish's huge back porch overlooking an impressive piece of property.
Your house is amazing, Catherine said. Thanks. I got lucky in college and licensed some software I'd written.
Metasystems stuff?
A precursor to Metasystems. Following 9/11, the government was intercepting and crunching enormous data fields. Civilian email, cell phone, fax, text, websites.
Sniffing for keywords associated with terrorist communications.
So I wrote a piece of software that let them process their data field in a second way, pulling from it an additional intelligence product.
She smiled.
Essentially, my software let them take America's temperature.
I'm sorry?
Trish laughed.
Yeah, sounds crazy, I know. What I mean is that it quantified the nation's emotional state. It offered a kind of cosmic consciousness barometer, if you will.
Trish explained how, using a data field of the nation's communications, one could assess the nation's mood based on the occurrence density of certain keywords and emotional indicators in the data field. Happier times had happier language, and stressful times vice versa. In the event, for example, of a terrorist attack, the government could use data fields to measure the shift in America's psyche and better advise the president on the emotional impact of the event.
Fascinating, Catherine said, stroking her chin. So, essentially, you're examining a population of individuals as if it were a single organism.
Exactly. A metasystem. A single entity defined by the sum of its parts. The human body, for example, consists of millions of individual cells, each with different attributes and different purposes, but it functions as a single entity.
Catherine nodded enthusiastically.
Like a flock of birds or a school of fish moving as one. We call it convergence or entanglement.
Trish sensed her famous guest was starting to see the potential of metasystem programming in her own field of noetics.
My software, Trish explained, was designed to help government agencies better evaluate and respond appropriately to wide-scale crises, pandemic diseases, national tragedies, terrorism, that sort of thing.
She paused. Of course, there's always the potential that it could be used in other directions.
Perhaps to take a snapshot of the national mindset and predict the outcome of a national election or the direction the stock market will move at the opening bell.
Sounds powerful.
Trish motioned to her big house.
The government thought so.
Catherine's gray eyes focused in on her now.
Trish, might I ask about the ethical dilemma posed by your work?
What do you mean?
I mean, you created a piece of software that can easily be abused. Those who possess it have access to powerful information not available to everyone. You didn't feel any hesitation creating it?
Trish didn't blink.
Absolutely not. My software is no different than, say, a flight simulator program. Some users will practice flying first aid missions into underdeveloped countries. Some users will practice flying passenger jets into skyscrapers. Knowledge is a tool, and like all tools, its impact is in the hands of the user.
Catherine sat back, looking impressed.
So, let me ask you a hypothetical question.
Trish suddenly sensed their conversation had just turned into a job interview. Catherine reached down and picked up a tiny speck of sand off the deck, holding it up for Trish to see.
It occurs to me, she said, that your metasystems work essentially lets you calculate the weight of an entire sandy beach by weighing one grain at a time.
Yes, basically that's right.
As you know, this little grain of sand has mass. A very small mass, but mass nonetheless.
Trish nodded.
And because this grain of sand has mass, it therefore exerts gravity. Again, too small to feel, but there.
Right.
Now, Catherine said, if we take trillions of these sand grains and let them attract one another to form, say, the moon, then their combined gravity is enough to move entire oceans and drag the tides back and forth across our planet.
Trish had no idea where this was headed, but she liked what she was hearing.
So, let's take a hypothetical,
Catherine said, discarding the sand grain.
What if I told you that a thought, any tiny idea that forms in your mind, actually has mass? What if I told you that a thought is an actual thing, a measurable entity with a measurable mass? A minuscule mass, of course, but mass nonetheless. What are the implications?
Hypothetically speaking?
Well, the obvious implications are, if a thought has mass, then a thought exerts gravity and can pull things toward it.
Catherine smiled.
You're good. Now take it a step further. What happens if many people start focusing on the same thought? All the occurrences of that same thought begin to merge into one, and the cumulative mass of this thought begins to grow. And therefore, its gravity grows.
Okay.
Meaning, if enough people begin thinking the same thing, then the gravitational force of that thought becomes tangible, and it exerts actual force.
Catherine winked.
And it can have a measurable effect in our physical world.
Chapter 19. Director Inoue Sato stood with her arms folded, her eyes locked skeptically on Langdon as she processed what he had just told her.
He said he wants you to unlock an ancient portal. What am I supposed to do with that, Professor?
Langdon shrugged weakly. He was feeling ill again, and tried not to look down at his friend's severed hand. That's exactly what he told me. An ancient portal, hidden somewhere in this building. I told him I knew of no portal.
Then why does he think you can find it?
Obviously he's insane.
He said Peter would point the way.
Langdon looked down at Peter's upstretched finger, again feeling repulsed by his captor's sadistic play on words. Peter will point the way. Langdon had already permitted his eyes to follow the pointing finger up to the dome overhead.
A portal? Up there? Insane.
This man who called me, Langdon told Sato, was the only one who knew I was coming to the capital tonight. So whoever informed you I was here tonight, that's your man. I recommend—
Where I got my information is not your concern,
Sato interrupted, voice sharpening.
My top priority at the moment is to cooperate with this man. And I have information suggesting you are the only one who can give him what he wants.
And my top priority is to find my friend, Langdon replied, frustrated. Sato inhaled deeply, her patience clearly being tested.
If we want to find Mr. Solomon, we have one course of action, Professor, to start cooperating with the one person who seems to know where he is.
Sato checked her watch.
Our time is limited. I can assure you it is imperative we comply with this man's demands quickly.
How? Langdon asked, incredulous. By locating and unlocking an ancient portal? There is no portal, Director Sato. This guy's a lunatic.
Sato stepped close, less than a foot from Langdon.
If I may point this out, your lunatic deftly manipulated two fairly smart individuals already this morning.
She stared directly at Langdon, and then glanced at Anderson.
In my business, one learns there is a fine line between insanity and genius. We would be wise to give this man a little respect.
He cut off a man's hand.
My point exactly. That is hardly the act of an uncommitted or uncertain individual. More important, Professor, this man obviously believes you can help him. He brought you all the way to Washington, and he must have done it for a reason.
He said the only reason he thinks I can unlock this portal is that Peter told him I can unlock it, Langdon countered.
And why would Peter Solomon say that if it weren't true?
I'm sure Peter said no such thing, and if he did, then he did so under duress. He was confused or frightened.
Yes, it's called interrogational torture, and it's quite effective. All the more reason Mr. Solomon would tell the truth.
Sato spoke as if she'd had personal experience with this technique.
Did he explain why Peter thinks you alone can unlock the portal?
Langdon shook his head.
Professor, if your reputations are correct, then you and Peter Solomon both share an interest in this sort of thing. Secrets, historical esoterica, mysticism, and so on. In all of your discussions with Peter, he never once mentioned to you anything about a secret portal in Washington, D.C.?
Langdon could scarcely believe he was being asked this question by a high-ranking officer of the CIA. I'm certain of it. Peter and I talk about some pretty arcane things, but believe me, I'd tell him to get his head examined if he ever told me there was an ancient portal hidden anywhere at all, particularly one that leads to the ancient mysteries. She glanced up.
I'm sorry. The man told you specifically what this portal leads to?
Yes, but he didn't have to. Langdon motioned to the hand. The Hand of the Mysteries is a formal invitation to pass through a mystical gateway and acquire ancient secret knowledge. Powerful wisdom known as the Ancient Mysteries, or the Lost Wisdom of all the ages.
So, you've heard of the secret he believes is hidden here?
A lot of historians have heard of it.
Then how can you say the portal does not exist?
With respect, ma'am, we've all heard of the Fountain of Youth and Shangri-La, but that does not mean they exist. The loud squawk of Anderson's radio interrupted them.
Chief,
the voice on the radio said. Anderson snatched his radio from his belt.
Anderson here.
Sir, we've completed a search of the grounds. There's no one here that fits the description. Any further orders, sir? Anderson shot a quick glance at Sato, clearly expecting a reprimand, but Director Sato seemed uninterested. Anderson moved away from Langdon and Sato, speaking quietly into his radio.
Sato's unwavering focus remained on Langdon.
You're saying the secret he believes is hidden in Washington is a fantasy?
Langdon nodded. A very old myth. The secret of the ancient mysteries is pre-Christian, actually. Thousands of years old.
And yet it's still around.
As are many equally improbable beliefs. Langdon often reminded his students that most modern religions included stories that did not hold up to scientific scrutiny. Everything from Moses parting the Red Sea to Joseph Smith using magic eyeglasses to translate the Book of Mormon from a series of gold plates he found buried in upstate New York. Wide acceptance of an idea is not proof of its validity.
I see. So what exactly are these ancient mysteries?
Langdon exhaled. Have you got a few weeks? In short, the ancient mysteries refer to a body of secret knowledge that was amassed long ago. One intriguing aspect of this knowledge is that it, allegedly, enables its practitioners to access powerful abilities that lie dormant in the human mind. The enlightened adepts who possessed this knowledge vowed to keep it veiled from the masses because it was considered far too potent and dangerous for the uninitiated.
Dangerous in what way?
The information was kept hidden for the same reason we keep matches from children. In the correct hands, fire can provide illumination. But in the wrong hands, fire can be highly destructive. Sato took off her glasses and studied him.
Tell me, Professor, do you believe such powerful information could truly exist?
Langdon was not sure how to respond. The ancient mysteries had always been the greatest paradox of his academic career. Virtually every mystical tradition on Earth revolved around the idea that there existed arcane knowledge capable of imbuing humans with mystical, almost godlike powers. Tarot and I Ching gave men the ability to see the future. Alchemy gave men immortality through the fabled Philosopher's Stone. Wicca permitted advanced practitioners to cast powerful spells. The list went on and on. As an academic, Langdon could not deny the historical record of these traditions, troves of documents, artifacts, and artwork that, indeed, clearly suggested the ancients had a powerful wisdom that they shared only through allegory, myths, and symbols, ensuring that only those properly initiated could access its power. Nonetheless, as a realist and a skeptic, Langdon remained unconvinced. "Let's just say I'm a skeptic," he told Sato. "I have never seen anything in the real world to suggest the ancient mysteries are anything other than legend, a recurring mythological archetype. It seems to me that, if it were possible for humans to acquire miraculous powers, there would be evidence. And yet so far, history has given us no men with superhuman powers." Sato arched her eyebrows.
"That's not entirely true."
Langdon hesitated, realizing that for many religious people, there was indeed a precedent for human gods, Jesus being the most obvious. "Admittedly," he said, "there are plenty of educated people who believe this empowering wisdom truly exists, but I'm not yet convinced."
"Is Peter Solomon one of those people?"
Sato asked, glancing toward the hand on the floor. Langdon could not bring himself to look at the hand. "Peter comes from a family lineage that has always had a passion for all things ancient and mystical."
"Was that a yes?"
Sato asked. "I can assure you that even if Peter believes the ancient mysteries are real, he does not believe they are accessible through some kind of portal hidden in Washington, D.C. He understands metaphorical symbolism, which is something his captor apparently does not." Sato nodded.
"So you believe this portal is a metaphor?"
"Of course," Langdon said, "in theory, anyway. It's a very common metaphor, a mystical portal through which one must travel to become enlightened. Portals and doorways are common symbolic constructs that represent transformative rites of passage. To look for a literal portal would be like trying to locate the actual gates of heaven." Sato seemed to consider this momentarily.
"But it sounds like Mr. Solomon's captor believes you can unlock an actual portal."
Langdon exhaled. "He's made the same error many zealots make, confusing metaphor with a literal reality. Similarly, early alchemists had toiled in vain to transform lead into gold, never realizing that lead to gold was nothing but a metaphor for tapping into true human potential, that of taking a dull, ignorant mind and transforming it into a bright, enlightened one." Sato motioned to the hand.
"If this man wants you to locate some kind of portal for him, why wouldn't he simply tell you how to find it? Why all the dramatics? Why give you a tattooed hand?"
Langdon had asked himself the same question, and the answer was unsettling. "Well, it seems the man we are dealing with, in addition to being mentally unstable, is also highly educated. This hand is proof that he is well-versed in the mysteries as well as their codes of secrecy, not to mention with the history of this room."
"I don't understand."
"Everything he has done tonight was done in perfect accordance with ancient protocols. Traditionally, the hand of the mysteries is a sacred invitation, and therefore it must be presented in a sacred place." Sato's eyes narrowed.
"This is the rotunda of the U.S. Capitol building, Professor, not some sacred shrine to ancient mystical secrets."
"Actually, ma'am," Langdon said, "I know a great number of historians who would disagree with you." At that moment, across town, Trish Dunn was seated in the glow of the plasma wall inside the cube. She finished preparing her search spider and typed in the 5 key phrases Catherine had given her. Here goes nothing. Feeling little optimism, she launched the spider, effectively commencing a worldwide game of Go Fish. At blinding speed, the phrases were now being compared to texts all over the world, looking for a perfect match. Trish couldn't help but wonder what this was all about. But she had come to accept that working with the Solomons meant never quite knowing the entire story. Chapter 20. Robert Langdon stole an anxious glance at his wristwatch. 7:58 p.m. The smiling face of Mickey Mouse did little to cheer him up.
"I've got to find Peter. We're wasting time."
Sato had stepped aside for a moment to take a phone call, but now she returned to Langdon.
"Professor, am I keeping you from something?"
"No, ma'am," Langdon said, pulling his sleeve down over his watch. "I'm just extremely concerned about Peter."
"I can understand, but I assure you the best thing you can do to help Peter is to help me understand the mindset of his captor."
Langdon was not so sure, but he sensed he was not going anywhere until the OS director got the information she desired.
A moment ago,
Sato said,
you suggested this rotunda is somehow sacred to the idea of these ancient mysteries?
Yes, ma'am.
Explain that to me.
Langdon knew he would have to choose his words sparingly. He had taught for entire semesters on the mystical symbolism of Washington, D.C., and there was an almost inexhaustible list of mystical references in this building alone. America has a hidden past. Every time Langdon lectured on the symbology of America, his students were confounded to learn that the true intentions of our nation's forefathers had absolutely nothing to do with what so many politicians now claimed. America's intended destiny has been lost to history. The forefathers who founded this capital city first named her Rome. They had named her river the Tiber, and erected a classical capital of pantheons and temples, all adorned with images of history's great gods and goddesses, Apollo, Minerva, Venus, Helios, Vulcan, Jupiter. In her center, as in many of the great classical cities, the founders had erected an enduring tribute to the ancients, the Egyptian obelisk. This obelisk, larger even than Cairo's or Alexandria's, rose 555 feet into the sky, more than 30 stories, proclaiming thanks and honor to the demigod forefather for whom this capital city took its newer name, Washington. Now, centuries later, despite America's separation of church and state, this state-sponsored rotunda glistened with ancient religious symbolism. There were over a dozen different gods in the rotunda, more than the original pantheon in Rome. Of course, the Roman pantheon had been converted to Christianity in 609, but this pantheon was never converted. Vestiges of its true history still remained in plain view. As you may know, Langdon said, this rotunda was designed as a tribute to one of Rome's most venerated mystical shrines, the Temple of Vesta.
As in the Vestal Virgins?
Sato looked doubtful that Rome's virginal guardians of the flame had anything to do with the U.S. Capitol building. The Temple of Vesta in Rome, Langdon said, was circular, with a gaping hole in the floor through which the sacred fire of enlightenment could be tended by a sisterhood of virgins whose job it was to ensure the flame never went out. Sato shrugged.
This rotunda is a circle, but I see no gaping hole in this floor.
No, not anymore. But for years, the center of this room had a large opening precisely where Peter's hand is now. Langdon motioned to the floor. In fact, you can still see the marks in the floor from the railing that kept people from falling in.
What?
Sato demanded, scrutinizing the floor.
I've never heard that.
Looks like he's right.
Anderson pointed out the circle of iron nubs where the posts had once been.
I've seen these before, but I never had any idea why they were there.
You're not alone, Langdon thought, imagining the thousands of people every day, including famous lawmakers, who strode across the center of the rotunda having no idea there was once a day when they would have plunged down into the Capitol crypt, the level beneath the rotunda floor. The hole in the floor, Langdon told them, was eventually covered, but for a good while those who visited the rotunda could see straight down to the fire that burned below. Sato turned.
Fire? In the U.S. Capitol?
More of a large torch, actually. An eternal flame that burned in the crypt directly beneath us. It was supposed to be visible through the hole in the floor, making this room a modern Temple of Vesta. This building even had its own Vestal Virgin, a federal employee called the Keeper of the Crypt, who successfully kept the flame burning for 50 years, until politics, religion, and smoke damage snuffed out the idea. Both Anderson and Sato looked surprised. Nowadays, the only reminder that a flame once burned here was the four-pointed star compass embedded in the crypt floor one story below them, a symbol of America's eternal flame, which once shed illumination toward the four corners of a new world.
So, Professor,
Sato said,
your contention is that the man who left Peter's hand here knew all this?
Clearly. And much, much more. There are symbols all over this room that reflect a belief in the ancient mysteries.
Secret wisdom,
Sato said, with more than a hint of sarcasm in her voice.
Knowledge that lets men acquire godlike powers.
Yes, ma'am.
That hardly fits with the Christian underpinnings of this country.
So it would seem, but it's true. This transformation of man into God is called apotheosis. Whether or not you're aware of it, this theme, transforming man into God, is the core element in this rotunda's symbolism.
Apotheosis?
Anderson spun with a startled look of recognition. Yes. Anderson works here. He knows. The word apotheosis literally means divine transformation, that of man becoming God. It's from the ancient Greek, apo, to become, theos, God. Anderson looked amazed.
Apotheosis means to become God? I had no idea. What am I missing?
Sato demanded. Ma'am, Langdon said, the largest painting in this building is called the Apotheosis of Washington, and it clearly depicts George Washington being transformed into a god. Sato looked doubtful.
I've never seen anything of the sort.
Actually, I'm sure you have. Langdon raised his index finger, pointing straight up. It's directly over your head. Chapter 21. The Apotheosis of Washington, a 4,664-square-foot fresco that covers the canopy of the Capitol Rotunda, was completed in 1865 by Constantino Brumidi. Known as the Michelangelo of the Capitol, Brumidi had laid claim to the Capitol Rotunda in the same way Michelangelo had laid claim to the Sistine Chapel, by painting a fresco on the room's most lofty canvas, the ceiling. Like Michelangelo, Brumidi had done some of his finest work inside the Vatican. Brumidi, however, immigrated to America in 1852, abandoning God's largest shrine in favor of a new shrine, the U.S. Capitol, which now glistened with examples of his mastery. From the trompe-l'oeil of the Brumidi corridors to the frieze ceiling of the vice president's room. And yet it was the enormous image hovering above the Capitol Rotunda that most historians considered to be Brumidi's masterwork. Robert Langdon gazed up at the massive fresco that covered the ceiling. He usually enjoyed his students' startled reactions to this fresco's bizarre imagery, but at the moment he simply felt trapped in a nightmare he had yet to understand. Director Sato was standing next to him, with her hands on her hips, frowning up at the distant ceiling. Langdon sensed she was having the same reaction many had when they first stopped to examine the painting at the core of their nation. Utter confusion. You're not alone, Langdon thought. For most people, the apotheosis of Washington got stranger and stranger the longer they looked at it. That's George Washington on the central panel, Langdon said, pointing 180 feet upward into the middle of the dome. As you can see, he's dressed in white robes, attended by 13 maidens, and ascending on a cloud above mortal man. This is the moment of his apotheosis, his transformation into a god. Sato and Anderson said nothing. Nearby, Langdon continued, you can see a strange anachronistic series of figures, ancient gods presenting our forefathers with advanced knowledge. There's Minerva giving technological inspiration to our nation's great inventors, Ben Franklin, Robert Fulton, Samuel Morse. Langdon pointed them out one by one. And over there is Vulcan helping us build a steam engine. Beside them is Neptune demonstrating how to lay the transatlantic cable. Beside that is Ceres, goddess of grain and root of our word cereal. She's sitting on the McCormick Reaper, the farming breakthrough that enabled this country to become a world leader in food production. The painting quite overtly portrays our forefathers receiving great wisdom from the gods. He lowered his head, looking at Sato now. Knowledge is power, and the right knowledge lets man perform miraculous, almost godlike tasks. Sato dropped her gaze back down to Langdon and rubbed her neck.
Laying a phone cable is a far cry from being a god.
Perhaps to a modern man, Langdon replied. But if George Washington knew that we had become a race that possessed the power to speak to one another across oceans, fly at the speed of sound, and set foot on our moon, he would assume that we had become gods, capable of miraculous tasks. He paused. In the words of futurist Arthur C. Clarke, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. Sato pursed her lips, apparently deep in thought. She glanced down at the hand and then followed the direction of the outstretched index finger up into the dome.
Professor, you were told Peter would point the way. Is that correct?
Yes, ma'am, but...
Chief,
Sato said, turning away from Langdon.
Can you get us a closer look at the painting?
Anderson nodded.
There's a catwalk around the interior of the dome.
Langdon looked way, way up to the tiny railing visible just beneath the painting and felt his body go rigid. There's no need to go up there. He had experienced that seldom-visited catwalk once before, as the guest of a U.S. senator and his wife, and he had almost fainted from the dizzying height and perilous walkway.
No need?
Sato demanded.
Professor, we have a man who believes this room contains a portal that has the potential to make him a god. We have a ceiling fresco that symbolizes the transformation of a man into a god, and we have a hand pointing straight at that painting. It seems everything is urging us upward.
Actually, Anderson interjected, glancing up,
not many people know this, but there is one hexagonal coffer in the dome that actually swings open like a portal, and you can peer down through it and...
Wait a second, Langdon said. You're missing the point. The portal this man is looking for is a figurative portal, a gateway that doesn't exist. When he said Peter will point the way, he was talking in metaphorical terms. This pointing hand gesture, with its index finger and thumb extended upward, is a well-known symbol of the ancient mysteries, and it appears all over the world in ancient art. This same gesture appears in three of Leonardo da Vinci's most famous encoded masterpieces, The Last Supper, Adoration of the Magi, and St. John the Baptist. It's a symbol of man's mystical connection to God.
As above, so below. The madman's bizarre choice of words was starting to feel more relevant now.
I've never seen it before,
Sato said.
Then watch ESPN, Langdon thought, always amused to see professional athletes point skyward in gratitude to God after a touchdown or home run. He wondered how many knew they were continuing a pre-Christian mystical tradition of acknowledging the mystical power above, which, for one brief moment, had transformed them into a god capable of miraculous feats.
If it's of any help, Langdon said, Peter's hand is not the first such hand to make an appearance in this rotunda. Sato eyed him like he was insane.
I beg your pardon?
Langdon motioned to her BlackBerry. Google George Washington Zeus. Sato looked uncertain, but started typing. Anderson inched toward her, looking over her shoulder intently. Langdon said, This rotunda was once dominated by a massive sculpture of a bare-chested George Washington, depicted as a god. He sat in the same exact pose as Zeus in the Pantheon. Bare chest exposed, left hand holding a sword, right hand raised with thumb and finger extended. Sato had apparently found an online image because Anderson was staring at her BlackBerry in shock.
Hold on, that's George Washington?
Yes, Langdon said. Depicted as Zeus.
Look at his hand, Anderson said, still peering over Sato's shoulder. His right hand is in the same exact position as Mr. Solomon's.
As I said, Langdon thought, Peter's hand is not the first to make an appearance in this room.
When Horatio Greenough's statue of a naked George Washington was first unveiled in the rotunda,
many joked that Washington must be reaching skyward in a desperate attempt to find some clothes. As American religious ideals changed, however, the joking criticism turned to controversy, and the statue was removed, banished to a shed in the East Garden. Currently, it made its home at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History, where those who saw it had no reason to suspect that it was one of the last vestigial links to a time when the father of the country had watched over the U.S. Capitol as a god, like Zeus, watching over the Pantheon. Sato began dialing a number on her BlackBerry, apparently seeing this as an opportune moment to check in with her staff.
What have you got?
She listened patiently.
I see.
She glanced directly at Langdon,
then at Peter's hand.
You're certain?
She listened a moment longer.
Okay, thanks.
She hung up and turned back toward Langdon.
My support staff did some research and confirms the existence of your so-called Hand of the Mysteries, corroborating everything you said. 5 fingertip markings, the star, the sun, the key, the crown, and the lantern. As well as the fact that this hand served as an ancient invitation to learn secret wisdom.
I'm glad, Langdon said.
Don't be, she replied curtly. It appears we're now at a dead end until you share whatever it is you're still not telling me.
Ma'am? Sato stepped toward him.
We've come full circle, Professor. You've told me nothing I could not have learned from my own staff, and so I will ask you once more. Why were you brought here tonight? What makes you so special? What is it that you alone know?
We've been through this, Langdon fired back. I don't know why this guy thinks I know anything at all. Langdon was half tempted to demand how the hell Sato knew that he was in the Capitol tonight. But they'd been through that, too. Sato isn't talking. If I knew the next step, he told her, I'd tell you, but I don't.
Traditionally, the hand of the mysteries is extended by a teacher to a student, and then, shortly afterward, the hand is followed up with a set of instructions, directions to a temple, the name of the master who will teach you something. But all this guy left for us is 5 tattoos, hardly...
Langdon stopped short. Sato eyed him.
What is it?
Langdon's eyes shot back to the hand.